Slavery has often been called America's original sin. Yet white American Unitarians, like most white Americans, were slow to speak out against slavery as an immoral institution. The Unitarian minister William Ellery Channing was no exception. Channing was a major voice for American Unitarianism in the early and mid-19th century. He served as the minister of the prestigious Federal Street Church in Boston from 1803 to 1842. Throughout his career, Channing's sermons explored the relationship between humanity and the divine, put forth Jesus as a moral teacher, and rejected the Trinity as non-biblical. As a result of both his stirring sermons and commitment to pastoral care, Channing's congregation grew significantly during his ministry. In his youth, Channing had been exposed to the institution of slavery while he worked as a tutor for a slave-owning family in Virginia. What he saw sickened him. It also led him to conclude that slaveholders were as much damaged by the institution as the slaves. However, Channing was slow to speak out against slavery. His position among the Boston elite and the marginalization he knew he would face if he spoke out led him to proceed cautiously. In 1825, when he finally began to put forth an anti-slavery position, he made it clear that while he was against slavery, he was also opposed to the radical rhetoric of the abolitionists. Because the Federal Street Church membership included many of Boston's most powerful industrialists who did not approve of Channing's anti-slavery position, Channing, for the most part, did not speak publicly on the matter. Conversations with the abolitionist and author Lydia Maria Child and with Unitarian minister Samuel J. May, both friends of Channing, caused him to change his course. In 1835, Channing published the book Slavery and began to advocate publicly for the gradual abolition of slavery. Channing's book affirmed the human rights of slaves and argued that slaves have the same rational nature and the same power of conscience as those who are not enslaved. This view met strong disapproval from the powerful Bostonians in Channing's congregation. The matter came to a head in 1840 when abolitionist Charles Fallon, a close friend of Channing, died. Channing preached a powerful sermon following Fallon's death and was then asked by the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society if a memorial service could be held at his church. When the Congregation Standing Committee rejected Channing's request to hold the memorial service at Federal Street Church, Channing essentially resigned as the congregation's minister. Although he and the congregation did not formally end the relationship, he relinquished his salary and ceased to act as their minister. He preached only once more to the congregation before his death in 1842.
Building the beloved community was the theme of our capital campaign that raised the funds that we needed for our renovation. A large percentage of our members supported this vision for our newly renovated church space and supported the idea of our needing a bigger home, a more open home, where we can fulfill our mission to deepen our lives and be a force for healing in the world. But this term, beloved community, has much deeper roots. History suggests that the philosopher Josiah Royce first coined the term in the early 1900s. He wrote of an ideal that would be achieved when individuals committed to something bigger than themselves. He preached that the beloved community would exist when people shared of themselves, and they in turn would be transformed by this commitment. We'd heard earlier in the service a quote from Clarence Skinner, a leading universalist at the turn of the 20th century. He said, "The beloved community is not an organization of individuals seeking private and selfish security for their souls. It is a new adventure, a spontaneous fellowship of consecrated men and women seeking a new world. It is the comradeship of those who forget themselves in their passion to find a common life where the good of all is the quest for each." Martin Luther King also used this term, the beloved community, often in his speeches and writing in the mid-20th century. He didn't see the beloved community as something utopian or unrealistic or even unachievable. Instead, he spoke of the beloved community as something we are living and creating right now through our own attitudes and our own actions. Some of you may be familiar with the reading in our hymnal of his words, "We are caught up in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny." I think we understand beloved community here at UUSS. We've created a loving circle of mutual care and support, a circle of commitment to each other and to those who find their way through our doors. We reach out to our community as well, our community partners that we share our offering with every Sunday. Many folks cook and serve meals at Loaves and Fishes and St. John's Shelter. We have groups of folks in the Faithful Friends program who visit immigrants in detention. We are building relationships in these ways with people in need, drawing our circle of love and commitment wider than just our own community. But I want to challenge us today to think about how we can widen that circle even more, to think of this idea of beloved community in a broader sense. Some of you may remember my sermons on heaven and hell that I gave early in this year. I preached that heaven nor hell are something in the afterlife, but that we are creating heaven or hell right here on earth by our actions and by our inactions. I shared how that revolutionary preacher, the Jesus of Nazareth, described this idea of the kingdom of heaven. He said it was not a place, but a way of being. The kingdom of heaven is not coming with things that can be observed, nor will we say, "Look, there it is," or "Here it is." For in fact, the kingdom of heaven is among you. This beloved community, the kingdom of heaven that Jesus spoke, is what we are creating through our attention to the world and by living our values. It is what we are creating when we reach across our differences. It is what we are creating when we build relationships of love and compassion. Our principles can guide us into this idea of the beloved community. Number one, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Everyone is worthy. And of course, number seven, the interdependent web of which we are all a part, telling us that we are all in this together, that we are all part of that network of mutuality that Martin Luther King talked about. The interdependent web tells us that what we do matters, not just to ourselves, not just to our community, but to our world. And building the beloved community means living in a way that recognizes our UU principles, recognizes this interconnectedness. But let's not forget some of those principles in the middle. Principle number two, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. And our sixth principle, the goal of world community with love and justice for all. Now, the key words in both of those two principles is justice. And justice is an important component of building the beloved community. When we say justice making, we mean caring about peace, having genuine respect for people, and working to ensure fairness and equity. The power of this beloved community framework is the idea of justice grounded in an awareness of our profound interconnectedness. But I think the real key to the beloved community idea is the recognition that it is about the radical restructuring of relationships. Relationships should be the focus of our justice work, not outcomes. We shouldn't enter justice work thinking, what problems can we fix? What do I have that I can bring to this problem, to solve this problem? We should enter our justice work thinking, who can I build a relationship with? What is my responsibility to others that I am in relationship with, and who else in this world do I need to reach out to? We must understand that in our profound interconnectedness, our definition of beloved community needs to expand beyond until it encompasses our whole world, our earth, and all beings. We must expand our circle of care and our circle of connection. So by now, I imagine that some of you may be thinking that this sounds like another group of UU buzzwords, the one for 2015, beloved community. Why make it complicated? Just live your life as best you can, right? Treat people fairly. Why do we have to have these terms and these constructs, or heaven forbid, these paradigms for how we approach these issues? But I don't think living your life the best you can and treating people fairly is enough. The world that we live in now is deeply interconnected, and as religious people, we do not have the luxury of ignorance. Building the beloved community is holding up your responsibility to fellow humans, your responsibility to the earth. For me, there is too much pain in this world to ignore, too much injustice that I personally am benefiting from, for me to be comfortable, for me to be complacent. My theology requires that I live with an awareness of our interdependence, that I live with an awareness of how my actions and choices affect others, whether directly or indirectly. Marian Anderson said, "No matter how big a nation is, it is no stronger than the weakest people. And as long as you keep a person down, some part of you has to be there to hold them down." Injustice can be understood as brokenness in relationships. For example, economic injustice is what happens when hardworking people are exploited and cannot earn enough to live on in spite of working full-time or even more than full-time. You are in relationship with those people if you shop at Walmart, or you eat at McDonald's, or you eat produce that is grown in California, or buy things from many, many places and systems that exploit working people. This is a violation of our human relationship with one another. But I know it can feel overwhelming. It's hard to imagine what one person can do. Everything is, it's so complex. Interconnectedness is complicated. That's why I appreciate this idea of building beloved community and an approach to justice that honors and recognizes relationships. And the idea of the beloved community that by widening your circle, by opening your heart to injustice, by acknowledging the relationships, you can be changed in the process. William Ellery Channing was changed in the process. I find it easy to relate to his journey. First seeing slavery when he was young, And then going home to Boston and not having to deal with it, he thought, because it was so far away in the South. You can see his evolution in the story that Christopher read to you. First, he said nothing to his church. And then he gently came out against slavery, but of course he said he did not support those radical abolitionists that were making everybody so upset in New England. 10 years after he first spoke out about slavery, he wrote his book. 10 years it took him to advocate publicly against slavery, and at that time he got in trouble with the leaders of his church. Businessmen who benefited from slavery in the textile mills where the cotton was used or in other goods that were benefiting from slavery. For 5 more years, Channing lived with the knowledge that the community that he loved, the church that he was with, did not share his values opposing slavery. Finally, it came down to his friendship with Charles Follen, an abolitionist who had lost his job as a professor at Harvard because he spoke out against slavery. When Channing's church said that they would not allow him to have the memorial there, he knew that that was the end of his ministry. I imagine those 15 years, how torn he was during those years, trying to reconcile what was in his heart with that of his church, the people he loved, the people he cared about, the fact that he couldn't be honest. And even when he first stepped out and spoke against slavery, he didn't want to be associated with those radical abolitionists. Finally, as his circle widened to include more people who shared his values, he couldn't deny his position. His circle had widened to include those working against slavery, and indeed, it widened to include those in slavery. He understood that it was all truly interconnected, and he couldn't continue tolerating the injustice. This idea of our involvement in social justice work as not a fixing action, but a relationship, reminds me of a story of a friend of mine who got involved in a tutoring program for students at a school with many, many different languages spoken, many children from different countries. He was tutoring this young fellow, a fourth grader, twice a week for this school year. This is someone that he would not have interacted with otherwise. And in their time together, they built a word web where all the words that they learned in reading, their favorite words they'd put on this web to help build the interconnection of their time together, a reflection, a piece of art. But the two words that the young fellow he worked with liked the most were not words that came out of their books, but they were words that came out of their relationship. One was Gesundheit, which my friend had said when the young fellow sneezed and was curious about it, and they included that German word in their web. The other was the definition of PS in a letter, a Latin term that they included, bringing German and Latin into their reading. So it turned out that he went to help this young man learn to read, but it was the relationship that was the most important thing after all. The relationship that ended up changing and giving to him as much as it did to the person that he was helping. Community organizers recognize the power of relationships, this one-to-one interaction that establishes grassroots awareness. This is the approach that got Barack Obama elected in 2008, the one that was so denigrated by Rudy Giuliani. People talking to people, raising awareness, building relationships. Some of us were amazed at how quickly the tide turned on marriage equality. It's like suddenly the majority approves. And yet those tables were turned because of the power of relationships. All over the state of California, community organizers were going door to door, having one-on-one conversations with people. It's easy to be against something that's foreign to you, foreign to your life. But when there's somebody standing on your front porch asking you to think differently, it's a little harder. When someone asks you to be respectful for other human beings, people who were against gay marriage were suddenly confronted with an actual person who they were oppressing. They recognized that they were part of the oppression of their neighbors, of their friends, maybe even their family members. Relationship required that they draw their circle wider. So let's take this beloved community lens now and apply it to what's going on in Baltimore, Ferguson, Cleveland, Oakland. I'm sure you can name other cities where we have these issues that are summarized in the statement, Black Lives Matter. How do we relate to what is happening in a way that is constructive and anti-oppressive? Can we see that these situations are actually broken relationships? Our culture wants to blame and polarize. Can we counter that tendency? Can we draw a circle of love and justice that holds both the police, the victims, their families, the protesters? Can we resist pointing fingers of blame, vilifying, quick answers, believing that we really understand what is going on? Martin Luther King said that rioting is the language of the unheard. Can you open your mind to the idea that people who are oppressed will lash out however they can? They will lash out when their children are being killed. Also unheard is the police who maybe want a different way of being, who feel as much oppressed by the police state as some of the victims do, but are afraid to speak out or break ranks. Can our circle be wide enough to include them? Can we see that in systems of institutionalized oppression, no one person is responsible for how it got that way, but we are all responsible for why it stays that way? To paraphrase Rebecca Parker, what is unfolding before our eyes is the cumulative effect of our nation's decision about how we manage the production and distribution of wealth, how we view crime and people of color, and how white privilege plays itself out, all in real time, on our TVs and our Facebook feeds. There were two articles in the Sacramento Bee in the past month that stood out for me. The first one was an editorial about how the high fines now that we're charging for minor traffic infractions are causing people that can't afford to pay them to have their cars impounded. And then when their cars are impounded, they can't go to work. And when they can't go to work, they lose their income. Is this how we want to treat people in our community? The other article in the Bee was about the Fresno police force and how they were using another form of policing, working with communities, building relationships, building trust. They talk about this community picnic that they started in a very difficult neighborhood, and after several years, it became a place where the police and the community and even some of the gang members would be together, see each other's faces, realized that they were not that different, that they shared some of the same values, that they affirmed the value of each person in community, and the police saw them as people rather than potential criminals, and the people in the community saw the police as possibly helpful rather than oppressors. As you consider my sermon this morning, please don't parse my words too carefully, and especially don't get hung up on terms. I don't care if you think that the beloved community is a paradigm that works for you. I don't care if justice making doesn't float your boat, if you have other terms. But I do care that you live your life with the awareness of your responsibility to others. I do care that you work to tear down oppression And I do care that you open your heart to the greater community, to people that are not like you. I do care that you speak out and act out when you see injustice. And I care most of all that you bring our UU values of justice and compassion into your life today and every day. My hope is that next year when we return to our remodeled home, we can turn our energies to widening our circle of care, that we can work to build the beloved community in the larger sense of the Sacramento region, that we can live out our mission in a bold and transformational way. UU Minister Mark Morrison Reed says that the central task of a religious community is to unveil the bonds that bind each to all, and that once felt inspire us to act for justice. May it be so. Amen.